On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we discuss the upcoming ASCA 2020 Winter Seminar, review the 2020 Joint Commission National Safety Goals, talk about employee appreciation, and do a focus segment on the purchasing cycle in an ASC with a special interview with Brian James, the Regional Director for Intelair, a prominent group purchasing organization serving the ASC industry.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 70 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for October 21st, 2019. We are recording from Virginia Beach, Virginia. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics.
So, Sue, here we are on vacation in Virginia Beach, working out of a temporary studio in the second bedroom of our condo here.
Yes. We have a nice little setup. You're having a little trouble with the sound levels and everything, trying to get everything set up just right. So
I know, and we're afraid that refrigerator is going to come on behind yes. you at any given time here. So we apologize for any noise problems that we have. It certainly is not ideal, like our studio, but and it's probably all user error.
Now, one of these days, we're going to have to take a picture of all of our makeshift studios to see. Maybe we don't really want people to know.
No, I don't think they want to know. So I want to remind everybody to become a patron of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey by going to the ASCpodcast.com website and clicking on the link in the upper right-hand corner of the site where you can support our program for as little as $10 a month. And the benefits of being a patron include the following, which is access to additional content, some example policies and procedures as we develop them from the podcast, copy of all the regulations and interpretive guidelines, example risk assessments, and the opportunity to interact directly with the hosts and other members of the Ambulatory Healthcare Strategy staff. So patrons also get free access to AEU credits for those that are certified Ambulatory Surgery Center Administrators, or CASC. For every 3 months that you're a member, you are eligible for 1/4 worth of AU credit. So we offered 1 AU credit for the third quarter, and hopefully for the fourth quarter here, we're looking at least 3 credits because we have a very mm-hmm. busy recording studio. I think as we mentioned in our last episode, we're going to pretty much weekly now because we have so much material that we have to get through with interviews that we've had with the upcoming 2020 CMS regulations, which are about to be posted shortly mm-hmm. on the CMS website.
Yep, lots of information to get out there.
That's right. And we also have a new sponsor coming on board with MedTrainer, who has agreed to do 3 episodes. So we have a lot of exciting things going on. So join us pretty much every week from here on out. And of course, we have 2 state association meetings coming up, one in Pennsylvania and mm-hmm. one in New York. So make sure that you're listening to those upcoming episodes. We also have a new store on our website, which, you know, I developed in order to, you know, make it easier for people to access things that are essential for an ambulatory surgery center. So it has a list of all the most important books your ambulatory surgery center needs in its library, as well as some products that we think would be very useful. So please check out the store at ascpodcast.com. Purchasing through the store helps us to continue the work of the podcast through commissions earned on sales through Amazon, which, by the way, don't cost you any more than purchasing directly from Amazon, mm-hmm. but it does help support the podcast.
Yeah. And it is, of course, a work in progress, so That's we right. will be adding more.
Absolutely. So the registration for ASCA 2020 Winter Seminar has started. For more information, go to the ASC Association ASC.org website. Sue, this is going to be very exciting. A lot of our employees are going there. I'm going to be speaking in the finance track. We have three tracks, ASC management, coding and reimbursement, and finance and accounting.
And you'll be doing some talks in the finance track.
That's correct. That's correct. So we really have two sections that are kind of unique this year, kind of a deep dive into the financial area where we talk, you know, basically developing a program that'll help people that aren't familiar with finances in ambulatory surgery centers, such as nurses who don't do an awful lot of finance but are trying to prepare for the CASC exam. So these sessions will really help you to prepare for that, as well as to know what's going on in the finance side.
And another unique thing about this conference is there's a great ASC management track that includes a half a day of infection prevention sessions, the ASC administrator's checklist for success, handling difficult conversations about an employee's performance, which can I think everybody can use some advice on, risk management, protecting your patient, staff, and ASC, federal regulations in your ASC, some information about patient record documentation, keys to success with your QAPI documentation, and a comprehensive guide to peer review. Also, developing a robust infection control program for your ASC. Now, I know we've mentioned this before, but remember, you can move between the tracks. You may be interested in one particular area, but you can jump back and forth. And the early bird registration rates go through November 15th, and you also get a discount after the first person from your center. You can get a discount on the second or third that would attend.
Right. And we'll be recording live from there, just like we do at all ASCA conferences. So you'll be able to hear about what's going on. But of course, there's nothing like actually attending the conference. So definitely go to the ASC Association website and sign up. On to news from the industry. So HHHC's weekly updates included notification that their July through December benchmarking studies are closed on October 31st. And topics for this six-month period include medication reconciliation, safe injection practices, and cataract extraction.
I wanted to talk about a study I saw referenced in ORAM from OR Manager on October 15th. It referred to an article in business.com that looked at how employee appreciation reduces turnover. I felt like this is a pretty relevant topic for a lot of ASCs.
Right. So I think it's a very relevant topic for many ASCs that unfortunately experience a lot of turnover.
Yep. And this is a pretty easy, low-cost intervention. So just some of the statistics. Employee appreciation increased engagement by almost 60%. Businesses that spent even 1% of payroll on recognition have a 79% greater likelihood of seeing positive financial results. So it's a great return on your investment. 82% of employees would prefer praise to a gift. And I thought, well, it probably depends on what that gift might be. But actually, another study found that 30% of employees would rather be recognized in a company-wide email from an executive than to receive a bonus of $500. So that's pretty significant. Companies with recognition programs have 31% less voluntary turnover. Yet looking at it from the other side, one study they cited showed that 34% of senior level respondents did not feel recognition had a significant effect on retention. So it's important to realize that it actually can. And it's been shown that the most effective recognition is individualized, timely, and honest. So not just some blanket statement, hey, you're doing a good job, you know, really recognize specific achievements. And there's just a lot of ways to do this regardless of your budget. I mean, you can write a thank you note. You can print out a recognition, something, and frame it. Put something in an employee newsletter. So I think there's a lot of ways of approaching this regardless of the size of your center or your budget.
On October 4th, the Joint Commission released its 2020 National Patient Safety Goals. They seem to be quite similar to last year, focusing on four main areas. First one is identifying patients correctly, using at least two identifiers, and making sure that we label specimens in the presence of the patients. I just did a survey, you know, in a GI center, for example, who had really an incredible process for labeling specimens. And it just goes to show how important it is to keep track of these things and how easy it is to kind of get into trouble if you're not doing a very good job of it.
And under using medication safely, their other category was labeling all medication containers, including syringes and medicine cups, if they're not immediately administered. And by that, we mean if you set them down at all, that's not considered to be immediate.
And this is one of those areas that I find frequently during surveys and during mock surveys are an ongoing issue. I'm surprised that we still have this issue today, even with all the attention that we put on it. But anesthesiologists in particular, because they tend to be dealing with a lot of the drugs that are used in the center. Yes. So what are those things that need to be on that label?
You have to have the medication or solution name, the strength, the amount of the medication, the diluent name and volume, the expiration date, and the initials of the person who is drawing that up.
So how do you fit this all on a label?
Right. Very small, but we also have suggested maybe pre-printing.
Very easy to find online is to get these pre-printed. And they're often very colorful, a little bit easier to determine what drugs they are there. Mm-hmm. And the ideal labels are those that have everything on except the initials and the time.
Mm-hmm. Anything you can do to make it easier and more routine is just going to increase your compliance. Under that same category, always verify medication visually and verbally. This should be done with two individuals when the person drawing up the medication is not the same one who is administering it.
And I think I gave an example a number of episodes ago where we talked about a medication error where they administered the wrong drug. Mm-hmm. And the people that were drawing it up remember very distinctly afterwards spending a lot of time looking at the vial, but they spent so much time looking for the expiration date, they failed to actually read the name on the label. And that's what caused that medication error.
And also medication reconciliation, which is becoming kind of a big topic, which, of course, is the process of comparing the medications a patient is taking and should be taking at home with any newly ordered medications. They suggest making a good faith effort to obtain an accurate list of patients' medications because they realize that you just can't always get accurate information. Providing written information about any newly prescribed medications, when to take them, how to take them, for how long, when did they just, if there's anything you ask them to hold off on of their own regular medications, make sure it's very explicit in this written information.
And that reconciliation should also make a statement about how do you resume or stop any of the medications that were listed in the preoperative questions. I just recently did a survey again where there was no medication reconciliation, no specific form for this. So really the only way that you can completely meet these standards is by, you know, having a special form that includes all of the drugs that the patient had before the surgery, any new medications that were prescribed afterwards, as well as a statement by the physician as to what to do with them and a signature. And then the patient has a copy of this when they go home.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this starts in the pre-op phone call, reminding patients to either bring all of their medications with them or have a good accurate list. And they really, it's good recommendation anyways, just to have them to remind people to always have that list with them.
Right. And I think somebody gave a suggestion. I was just thinking about this, asking the patient to take a picture of the vials each of these drugs if they don't want to spend the time writing them all down on a sheet of paper.
Yeah. And one of the other goals was preventing infection. And parts to this are educating staff from new hires, then education again annually. And whenever new involvement in surgical procedures are added to the employees' responsibilities, make sure to do that specific education. Educating patients and family members is also very important. Performing risk assessments.
And this is both ongoing risk assessments for the infection control area as well as a risk assessment anytime you do construction.
And ongoing monitoring and surveillance, which may be or should be based on the results of the risk assessments.
Right. The whole goal of doing those risk assessments is to develop the policies and procedures and any surveillance techniques that you're going to have in your as part of your quality improvement program.
Knowing where to focus and tracking any infection rates. Hopefully there aren't many, but if you have any, make sure you're tracking those. And consider the use of antimicrobial agents on a prophylactic basis for certain procedures.
And the next area in the 2020 Joint Commission goals was preventing mistakes in surgery, which is still an ongoing problem. As we talked about in a previous episode, the third leading cause of death right now in the United States is medical errors.
So these include universal protocol for preventing wrong site, wrong procedure, wrong person surgery, including pre-procedure verification, site marking, and the timeout procedures. They should be as consistent as possible throughout the organization so that everybody knows what they're doing. You don't forget any of the important components. Identify any needed items before the procedure begins using a standardized list, including any relevant documentation, diagnostic and radiology test results, any required devices, implants, or special equipment, and of course, conducting a timeout immediately before starting the procedures. This has to involve all team members. That is so important. We see that so often. You have to make sure everybody's focused on it, make sure everybody that's going to be involved in the surgery is present and paying attention. Designate a team member who is responsible for the timeout. and make it a standardized procedure so that everybody, again, knows exactly what they're speaking about, what they need to pay attention to. Mention the patient identification, the site, the procedure. Always, if there's more than one procedure going on, make sure to do the timeout immediately before each of those, and always document your timeout.
And also include information about the patient's allergies and any other situations reactions that the team should know. And Sue, I've been doing quite a number of surveys and mock surveys recently, and I got to tell you, it's still an ongoing problem. I think what surprises me, when they know I'm watching them,
yeah,
we still have a problem with timeouts. So if anybody has problems with this, hang a sign in the room that lists all the steps for the timeout. And again, make sure that everybody on that team acknowledges that they heard the timeout and agree with everything that's going on. I can't stress this enough, given, some of the complications that we've had recently.
Yeah, kind of empower whoever is in charge of it to stop and just say, I'm waiting until, even if it's the doctor or the anesthesiologist who's not paying attention.
That's right.
Stop, hold everything up, make everyone wait until they pay attention.
And I wanted to finish this segment by talking about some information that came from the ASC Association, which I thought was kind of interesting. The top 10 states with ASCs in the United States by order. So California wins the award with the highest number of ambulatory surgery centers at 794. Florida is second, not a big surprise given the population of older people there, at 426 centers. Texas is third at 391. Georgia, which is a bit of a surprise to me, is fourth with 350. Maryland at 346. New Jersey at 259. Pennsylvania at 244. Washington, which is a real surprise to me up there in the Northwest, at 188. Arizona at 181. And last in top 10 was Ohio with 181. So I just thought that was kind of interesting information. So let's take a short break and we'll come back with our focus segment on the purchasing cycle. So for this segment, Sue, I thought we would, at the risk of making your eyes glaze over, talk about the purchasing cycle in ambulatory surgery center. We do get comments from our listeners all the time about how they want a little bit more financial content. Mm-hmm. So I thought this would be a very good area to talk about, especially since we did an interview with an individual from a group purchasing organization, and we'll have that interview at the end of the section. So let's just start by talking about what the purchasing cycle is. So the purchasing cycle in ambulatory surgery center involves a process of buying goods and services that a surgery center will need to provide the services that it provides to patients. These goods and services include both the supplies necessary for the procedures itself, as well as the supplies and services necessary to support the surgical services. Purchasing procedures are the activities necessary to obtain the quantity and quality of products and services required to provide the quality of services that the organization wishes to provide at a reasonable price. So that didn't exactly read that well, but I think it gets the point across.
Makes sense.
So let's talk about the purchasing cycle in ambulatory surgery center. So I thought I'd start this discussion by talking about accounts payable management. So accounts payable is the amount of money that is owed to vendors of the organization. It's the amount that you've been invoiced for, but you haven't yet paid. And the main reason that you haven't paid it is probably because the invoice isn't due yet, or you're still researching as to whether that's a valid invoice, which of course is an ongoing problem in many surgery centers. And I can't stress enough the importance of timely payment. I still remember many, many years ago, 30 years ago when I first started out, the ambulatory surgery center I was working for at the time had a pretty significant cash flow problem because they hadn't received their reimbursement yet, and yet all the expenses, of course, were due and payable. So we had to pick and choose as to how much we were paying to everybody. And it took us 2 to 3 years to recover from that because our Dun & Bradstreet report, which is the equivalent of a credit bureau report, for personal finances, wasn't very good. And Dun & Bradstreet track all the information that's provided by creditors as to, how timely that organization is in paying.
Is that something that all surgery centers should be checking, like we check our personal credit ratings?
That's a really good question, actually, because I do encourage people to, on a periodic basis, check to see what the Dun & Bradstreet report is for your organization, because it does make a big determination as to how much credit would be extended to an ambulatory surgery center, as well as, you know, sometimes that information in the Dun & Bradstreet is incorrect, just like it might be incorrect in your personal credit report. So it's always a good thing. I don't believe it costs any money to check your Dun & Bradstreet mm-hmm. reports and do it on a regular basis. Processing accounts payable invoices can be quite complex, and just paying those invoices without looking at them carefully is problematic. You want to make sure that invoices are paid only when you can verify that you've actually ordered the items, that you've received those items, and that those items were received in the quantities and of the quality that you expected to purchase. So this comes down to, you know, having very strong internal controls over accounts payable, making sure that you have like a purchase order system in place, or that all orders are approved by, you know, management prior to mm-hmm. that order being placed.
It's sort of an easy way to check to make sure that what you ordered is what came in, what you're being billed for is what
right.
you asked for.
So ways to improve your accounts payable function is to make sure that you do have that strong approval process, especially for large purchases. You know, large purchases, say over $5,000, should probably be approved, not in the ordinary course of business, of course. It should be approved by the governing body. I would really recommend you use purchase orders. Many of those computer systems out there that we know and love and work with on a daily basis have a mechanism for doing these purchase orders. And indeed, there are online systems available to be able to order directly online from vendors that will tie into those computerized systems. So that gets down to the ultimate payment of that invoice. You want to make sure that you're comparing the purchase order to the invoice to the receiving document. And only when all three of those documents agree will you actually tell your accounts payable person to cut a check for that. And, you know, it's interesting, Sue, when I was an administrator, I found that I think at least 50% of the invoices that we had were incorrect, that there was some type of information such as the wrong price was on the invoice, the wrong quantity was received, or we didn't receive that quantity. Mm-hmm. And often it was because there were problems with the order. For example, maybe not the entire order didn't come in at the same time, mm-hmm. or many items were back ordered.
Okay, so very worth keeping an eye on that.
That's right. It. And you can certainly save a lot of money that way. And then, of course, there are people that will, you know, are out to cheat you. So mm-hmm. there used to be this scam a while ago where this company would call you up and ask for the receptionist what the model number was for your copy machine, just to make sure that they were shipping the right toner. Well, it turns out that mm-hmm. that poor receptionist just gave them that information. That company took that as an order, shipped the toner, and it turns out that they didn't need that because the toner was already included with the mm-hmm. cost of renting that that copy machine. And by the way, that toner was never of high quality, and certainly would at a much higher price than you would pay for if you had purchased it in a normal manner. Also, if the vendor gives you an opportunity to have a early payment discount, such as we refer to that in the accounting field as 210 net 30, for example, which means you get a 2% discount if you pay within 10 days. Think about that. A 2% discount off of all of your purchases in a year could be a substantial amount of money. Now, not every vendor, of course, does that, but the faster you pay, the more money that you would save, and that's certainly a big advantage. I always say pay on time, but not early. So when you're setting up your accounting system, make sure that you pay those vendors on time, but don't pay a day earlier than you have to so mm-hmm. that you maintain a good cash
flow. Unless you get that discount.
That's right, exactly. And then lastly in this area of accounts payable is making sure you review the accounts payable aging on a periodic basis. We all know, or should know, that we have to review the accounts receivable aging to see how old the receivables are. We want to do the same thing with accounts payable to make sure that our accounts payable department is not holding up payments inappropriately, or that if they are holding up payments, that you understand what's causing that holdup. Mm-hmm. And the reason that we want to look at these things is just to make sure that some of our important vendors are not getting paid late. You know, you want to know as an administrator beforehand if there's any problems coming down the pike before you're hit with late payment penalties, or the worst thing is when they stop shipping to you because you haven't paid your bills. So a big part of making sure your accounts payable controls, your internal controls are strong is of course, to avoid the possibility of fraud. So good processes and controls will minimize, but they're certainly not going to eliminate the possibility mm-hmm. that the organization will be defrauded. And one way that you can be defrauded is, as I mentioned, that one situation. But other things that can happen is somebody can set up illegal companies or shell companies that just send invoices out to you with legitimate sounding services. We see this, for example, in Yellow Page advertising. You might get an invoice from what's called the Yellow Pages. Well, it's probably just some company that called themselves the Yellow Pages and made it sound like this is the normal annual fee that you have to pay. And there's a lot of Yellow Pages, of course, kind of going by the wayside now with the advent of the internet. But we're finding all kinds of organizations popping up and sending out bills for services that were certainly not rendered. So if you don't recognize what the bill is, don't pay it and certainly look into it further. Then let's move on to inventory management. It's always a tough thing because nurses, this is an area that they hate having to do inventory. They hate having to, do those inventory counts. And accountants, of course, would love to have that inventory done more frequently, like daily. But nurses will say, well, isn't once a year enough? So we always have to compromise somewhere in between, daily and once a year. Ambulatory surgery centers always have inventory issues. Multi-specialty centers in particular have to maintain, relatively large inventory numbers. And, one of the frequent numbers that we use, or one of the frequent statistics that we use, is the number of days in inventory. Mm-hmm. And that is basically a calculation of how many days, presumably, would it take before you ran out without purchasing any more supplies of the inventory that you have on hand. And average ambulatory surgery center is going to be somewhere between 30 and 60 days. Lower numbers are going to be for those single specialties, which are able to predict their volume a lot better, such as eye centers and GI centers, pain management. And the ones that are going to have a much more difficult problem are going to be orthopedic centers, which have a wide variety of different procedures that they do and a pretty unpredictable volume in many cases, or in most cases. So the other thing about inventory is purchasing items for your inventory is very complex in an ambulatory surgery center. We have, literally thousands of different items, different vendors that you can purchase this, and different types of quality that would be involved. And of course, sometimes you can't get it from one vendor. You might have to go to another vendor. So that makes the issue much more complicated.
Or with an overall shortage, having to recalculate how much you have to keep in stock with like some of the medications that are
absolutely. And you're right, exactly right, Sue. That's where a lot of the problems in recent years have come, is with the pharmacy purchases, because you want to stock up, but you don't want to overstock because you don't want those drugs to be outdated before you're able to use them. And then, of course, I think the big issue that we found with propofol, for example, is where do you store all of these drugs once you order them, let alone have an issue with the expiration dates. One of the concepts that I love in ambulatory surgery centers, and especially when I was running an eye surgery center, is just-in-time inventory, which, as I like to say, an organization that I ran, before I became an independent consultant full-time, I get in there at morning at 6 o'clock, and there would the truck, from the distributor be dropping off the supplies that we were indeed going to use that day. So we maintain a very lean inventory, but it was easy to do in that type of a center because the volume was easily predictable. It was very predictable. So here's some suggestions for managing your inventory. First of all, nowadays, especially with the advent of things like Amazon Prime, we're all used to not having to pay for shipping, which allows us to have more frequent shipments. And even for the manufacturers and distributors, they're willing to do this more because it maintains, lower inventory levels in the warehouses also. Also, consignment inventories. This is where you maintain an inventory in your facility, but you actually don't own those supplies. You didn't purchase them. Consignment means that they have been placed in your organization. You only pay for them when you've actually used them. Obviously, periodic inventory counts, as I said, Sue, daily inventories, and making sure the nurses do all those inventories. But I say at least semi-annual, preferably quarterly, is probably much more reasonable. Using management information systems that have online or just-in-time inventory management systems. And most of those major systems out there that we use in the ASC space have this built into it. Electronic inventory interfaces, where we're directly interfaced with the distributor for the items that you're purchasing. Making sure that you have regular shipments so that you can determine how frequently you need to purchase certain items and have them come on a regular basis without you really having to do a lot of intervention with the ordering. Not being afraid of overnight charges. If you do procedures infrequently and then suddenly you have a case that comes up for the next day, you might find it more advantageous to only order those items when you know that you have a case rather than storing them and taking the risk that you'll never do that procedure again or that the supplies will expire. And then lastly, probably the most efficient way that you can maintain an inventory is setting order points. Order points are those things where you set a number of items in inventory, and once that level drops below that point, you automatically order new supplies. So one of the things that we always talk about when I speak about this in major conferences is, what are the costs associated with inventory management? Obviously, you've got the ordering cost. What does it cost to actually purchase supplies and making sure that you maintain the lowest cost that you can in this area, minimizing the number of times that you have to order supplies, and also maximizing the efficiency in your purchasing function. Holding costs. Those are the costs associated with holding items that you're most likely not going to use. I remember many years ago, we used to have these screws that were only used on one case out of 1,000. And, I think we had $20,000 worth of these these items, which were never used. And they were all sitting in a corner there. But we had them just in case we did that procedure. Well, in today's world, we probably would never do that. We would just order those things immediately before the procedure. And then the flip side of that is insufficient inventory costs. That's, are you going to lose a case because you don't have the supplies? Let's say that, for example, a doctor says that he wants to do a shoulder arthroscopy in the afternoon, and there's just no way that you're going to be able to get those supplies in time to be able to do the procedure. So if you know that that's going to happen frequently, you make sure that you have, extra supplies on hand to be able to handle that. Otherwise, you're going to incur what we would call an insufficient inventory cost.
And who in your organization would usually make those purchases? Who would you look for?
That's a really good question. I've always found it interesting who we vest with the responsibility of purchasing all the supplies. It's a pretty big responsibility we give to individuals. And definitely somebody that has some type of a healthcare background is really important. They have to have knowledge of it. Just pulling somebody out of purchasing from a manufacturer, for example, is going to be a high learning curve. I did find during my career, though, that some of my best purchasers actually came from the military. Actually, I should say that in general about employees is that, they had a level of discipline and knowledge and dedication that was very unique. And working with individuals that had a military background was very, very good. But beyond that, nurses who no longer can work on the floor, say they're getting older no longer have the ability to stand for long periods of time, they make good purchasers if they want to do that. And sometimes you can split this duty and have them do, maybe work part of the day on the floor if they're still able to do that and still do the purchasing. And of course, in smaller centers, this whole thought of having an independent purchaser is probably not realistic, and that duty is going to fall on the administrator and the nurse manager. So this gets us to the topic of group purchasing organizations. Because most ambulatory surgery centers are small, to get the best prices, they're going to need to band together to aggregate their purchases and negotiate lower costs for products and services. And that's where group purchasing organizations come into play. They exist purely for that purpose. So during the Ohio conference, we spoke to Brian James, a friend of ours, and he's the regional director of IntelAir. We talked during this interview about what a group purchasing organization or GPO is and how it can help save you some money. So let's listen to this interview.
We're here with Brian James, regional director for IntelAir, and we're going to talk a little bit about GPOs.
So, Brian, welcome back to our show.
Yes,
you've been
thank
this
you.
Your third time.
It's been too long.
I know. And, we're here in Ohio actually doing a recording during the Ohio State Association, but you and I were talking and I said, we really haven't talked on this show about group purchasing organizations and what they can do. And a lot of our audience, has been clamoring for more financial information, from our podcast. So I thought you'd be a great person to talk about GPOs. My relationship with IntelAir and your predecessors goes back almost 30 years.
I can't
remember how, as long as you've been around.
That's right.
I'd like to start with, first of all, what is a GPO?
So at the true core of how a GPO operates, we will negotiate basically supplier agreements with a whole host of vendors, and we're governed under safe harbor law. So we actually get admin fees back from our members for the participation in the agreements that we negotiate with those vendors. And it can range from, 0.1% all the way up to 3%. GPOs by law are not allowed to charge more than 3%, or the vendors, we can't get more than 3%. And that's kind of a safe harbor. But we have to get fees on the behalf of our members and then report back to our members under safe harbor of the transactions that we've actually, where we got revenue. So that's basically the essence of how a GPO operates. We have about 2,000 agreements with probably 500 vendors, and we may have multiple contracts with the same vendor, for different categories.
So why should all of our listeners be part of a GPO?
Well, I think it's, I know especially in the non-acute space and maybe even more specifically the ASC space, they're not hospitals. We want to be able to provide a virtual IDN kind of environment. And that's what a GPO does, is it aggregates volume across a wide audience. and that gives them more buying power, more than what they could achieve on their own as a individual practice.
So as we well know, you know, and certainly most of our listeners are not necessarily affiliated with some big corporation or a hospital. So this is the way for them to become like the big guys. You know, they Correct. Have the same purchasing power that, say, that IDN or the hospital would have. And this is the mechanism for doing that, is working through a GPO.
Yeah. And so we have all classes of trade that, you know, I think some are a little more specialized GPOs. So we basically full service, we handle acute care, non-acute, you know, long-term care, ASC. So we really are covering the full gamut of where healthcare is being delivered today.
Right.
And again, like you said, they don't necessarily have the buying power. They want to remain independent, right. You know, and I think that's either, we're also seeing with critical access hospitals that are, you know, well needed in the communities. You know, we need to help keep their doors open. If they go away, then the healthcare system is worse off. But yeah. So we actually enable them to keep their doors open, right. Remain independent, so they don't necessarily have to get bought by a hospital group.
So I'm going to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
What type of savings, if you're not currently affiliated with a GPO, what type of savings can they expect? Let's say just general products. I mean, it gets a little more dicey when you get to specialized products.
Right.
But the general things that they use every day in an ambulatory surgery center.
I think, you know, and one of the things, we do so many cost studies. So we have some pretty good data that tells us kind of what the market is and what savings we've driven in our studies. Mm-hmm. On average, we're probably looking at 15 to 20% savings as a whole, sometimes more, sometimes a little bit less if they maybe have a current GPO in place.
So one of the things that I've noted over the years is sometimes we work with hospital-based ambulatory surgery centers, and I've had the privilege of looking at some of these contracts and the GPO arrangements. And this is kind of interesting, is that when you work with one of the GPOs that is affiliated with hospitals, and you compare that to the types of contracts that, you know, your employer, Intelair, mm-hmm. Has, we find we get better savings with an organization such as yours. And I don't want to, you know, put your company on the spot here.
Yeah.
But what I think my point being is that, you know, just because you have an agreement, or just because you're part of a hospital, or because the hospital partially owns you, doesn't mean you're going to get the best deals from a GPO that's affiliated with the hospital compared to one that specializes in outpatient.
Correct. Right. And even though you're affiliated with the hospital, you know, a lot of times it comes down to the specific vendor, if they're going to allow you to access acute care pricing.
Right.
I think they're being a little bit more kind of adamant on trying to have the pricing fit kind of the class of trade.
Right.
And I think, again, that's where some of our aggregation models. So when they've kind of prevented you from connecting to that contract through the hospital, then we can kind of be the, you know, kind of the facilitator to get you still competitive pricing, maybe not what you were before.
Yeah.
But certainly very competitive.
So how much does it cost to be part of a GPO?
It's funny you ask. So today it's free, and tomorrow it's free. No, so there is no cost.
There is no,
In fact, ironically, we used to charge an annual fee to become a member. We actually used to kind of require that they actually signed up for some contracts in order to become a member. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, there's no cost. Very simple paperwork to sign up. We actually have a lot of resources. Probably we haven't talked about this, you know. So besides our sales teams, we have clinical specialists. So in a lot of categories, and they are kind of the peer to peer. So we get involved with, you know, consulting on supply chain, you know, initiatives or value analysis. So we have a lot of extra resources besides our contracts.
So one of the first steps in getting involved with the GPO is doing an analysis. Can you, and again, this applies to both your organization and your competitors out there.
Right.
Kind of describe how that works. You know, so once somebody gets interested in becoming part of a GPO, you don't just stop at that. You just don't sign the agreement and immediately jump into it.
Right.
You do an analysis. Talk a little bit about how that analysis works.
Yeah. And there's, I guess I'll kind of classify it, 30,000 foot view versus, you know, 1,000 foot view. So we would like to start our analysis dive, which is a very quick way to assess what they can connect to within our portfolio. So we'll get an AP report. We'll see exactly who they've spent money with.
By the way, AP, not so everybody knows it. Accounts, some of these are nurses, you know, by the way.
Accounts payable or accounts register. But usually we ask that from our from the materials office, and they will – that's actually probably from the finance department.
Yeah.
So they will run a report in the last 12 months, vendor, and then – how much you've spent with them in that last year.
Gotcha.
So we put that through our contract portfolio, and we just look for, okay, that vendor matches one of our contracts for that vendor. It doesn't necessarily mean there's a direct match to that spend, but at least we know. And then also there's what we call the non-match file, which is all the other vendors we didn't have a match. But we also, there may be a comparable vendor to that that doesn't just come up in that direct match.
Right.
So it helps us kind of separate, you know, what do we want to focus on at the beginning? But really the core of GPOs is pharmacy, med-surg.
Right.
IT is becoming a real big spend these days, and that's where really technology is driving healthcare today. So we're seeing a lot more increase in spend. We actually do construction contracts. So if you're looking to build a facility, you know, we can actually help source some of the things, you know, like paint, carpeting, you know, so we can help that GC actually negotiate some of the contracts that you may be putting into that building.
Well, and one of my biggest relationships working with your organization in the past is pre-opening. Making sure all the equipment comes in, you know, giving the like list of what you need.
And, like the white glove service.
That's right.
Kind of new office setup. And we also have some distributor partners that do that as well.
And it doesn't stop with supplies and equipment. You also offer services. So, for example, Amateur Healthcare Strategies has been talking to you about, you know, a relationship moving forward too, you know, with regard to services. And that's kind of a new area for
it is for
GPOs.
Yeah, we've continued to have to, I think, GPO contracts, there's some point where we're all pretty competitive and close to each other. So now we have to find something that's of more value to our members.
Right.
Kind of the proverbial what keeps you up at night.
Yeah.
So we found that, you know, as healthcare, kind of the triple aim of, you know, lowering costs, improving outcomes, and driving efficiencies, we've built some solutions specifically that address those issues. Anything from insurance services we provide with Gallagher being our, so we have an insurance services arm, and just really supply chain excellence is really kind of our core competency. So we've built some solutions. A lot of it's very affordable. You know, I know that a lot of companies and organizations have spent money on, consultants. We actually have a very robust amount of consulting solutions at a very reasonable cost compared to like the Deloitte's and others kind of in the marketplace.
So one of the things that I've learned over the years is that this working with GPO is not just like set it and leave it.
Right.
And you and I, again, talked before the interview here about some of my experiences in the past and how, you know, often like people like you and I would set the arrangement up and then we would turn it over to, like I turn it over to a business office manager, you turn it over
To the sales rep. Yeah.
And then you find over time the purchasing through the GPO drops off just because of various things that are happening.
People
talk a little
busy.
Bit about, right, talk about the importance of ongoing relationship, how you maintain that ongoing relationship.
Yeah.
And when like the administrator or the chief executive officer of an ASC should probably step in, or how frequently they should step in.
Right. Yeah. And that's actually a good point. Well, a couple things from that is really data, again, is the driving force. It can either be people that are pulling data together, but we're also even trying to develop some technology that will automate the kind of the data sharing. So the more, you know, we know people get busy in their practices, the more we can automate and actually pull data from your systems, you know, we find that, or there may be even an e-procurement system that will help facilitate, you know, some of that data pull. So we're kind of looking at technology to help kind of drive some of that efficiency. And then we also do a, we'll do a quarterly business review with our key customers.
Yeah.
So actually we'll come in and we'll show you, you know, what you've spent through our contracts. Here's what you're connected to. You know, it provides a regular kind of conversation so that we're fulfilling, you know, and maybe some things that you haven't thought about that come through in that conversation that maybe we could do. And here's what we're doing. What more can we do to help benefit you?
So just speaking as a former administrator, one of the things that I would do on a regular basis is, you know, I'm the one that's signing those checks. I'm looking at the purchase orders, et cetera.
Right.
I would sit down with my my purchasing department. I'd sit down with my business office and I would say, and actually sometimes just ask a question. When was the last time you talked to your Amerinet, you know, coordinator?
Oh, yeah.
And if that answer was not within the last week, you know, I'd say, let's set up a meeting. Let's set up, you know, like where I sit down.
Sure.
Also to make sure that relationship stays alive. It's extremely important from my experience to make sure that that relationship continues and that there's an ongoing dialogue.
Yeah, there is definitely a, not even a 50-50. If everyone's given equally to the engagement, then I think those are the members that get the most benefit out of what we do. And another thing, when we do our business reviews, when we sit down, is not just to have materials there, but have, you know, facilities management.
Right.
So we want to have everybody that we could potentially impact. There shouldn't be any reason why they shouldn't be sitting in to say, okay, we're doing good here. Where else can we benefit? Because there's so much more we can do across the channel.
And I just want to end with an important point that we always try to talk about in this this podcast is the importance of tying all this in. This doesn't necessarily sound like something that falls into your quality improvement program, but it needs to be, because one of the things that surveyors look for and that you mm-hmm. should be looking for as part of improving the quality in your organization is looking not only at, you know, all of those things that obviously tie directly to the provision of care.
Right.
You know, obviously the quality of the products that you're using, the price effectiveness is right. important also. So all of the stuff that happens here should be part of your quality improvement program also. So
yeah, and I guess another thing I probably haven't touched upon is we're very member driven. Mm-hmm. We have member input groups that, you know, we don't come up with 2,000 contracts just because that's what we feel like is the right number. So we really vet out through a RFP process to make sure that we're bringing the best vendors. We're not just bringing vendors on just to get revenue.
Yeah.
And in fact, we're probably trimming down more our vendors just to give more value to those vendors. But also, you know, we want to pick the ones that either provide the most value or they may have some value added, you know, education programs they bring to the table. So we want to select carefully. And then we also get input from our members of, that's why when we pull that data on these AP reports I referred to, we may see one vendor show up consistently in the no match file. Mm-hmm. So we'll say, okay, that may be someone we want to talk to. So we really take all that data and we kind of put it through analysis so that we can continue to bring value and not just kind of sit on our laurels.
So thank you so much, Brian. It's great to have you back on, and we'll bring you back again.
Okay. Sounds good. So thanks, John.
Thanks for your time.
Yep.
Thank you, Brian, for that informative discussion. Now let's take a short break and come back to discuss upcoming events in the ASC industry. So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry.
Every episode, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you'd like to have your event included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
And remember that the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is available to support your ASC association. John is available to speak, and we can record a podcast from your meeting.
The Minnesota ASC Association's 2019 annual conference is this week, October 24th and 25th in Minnetonka, Minnesota.
The New York Metro ASC and Healthcare Management Symposium is November 1st, 2019 at the Marriott Marquis in New York.
The Pennsylvania ASC Association meeting will be November 4th, 2019 at the Hershey Lodge in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
The New York State Association of ASC's Fall Conference in Tarrytown, New York is on November 6th and 7th, 2019.
And we'll be recording a live episode and a special episode from there. And we'll have a bunch of our team members there, including Lori Rodericks, who's going to talk quite a bit about infection prevention.
Yep. And the California Association's 12th Annual Seminar, Infection Prevention and Surveillance in the ASC, is November 7th and 8th in Costa Mesa, California.
The Washington ASC Association's 2019 Annual Education Conference and Trade Show is November 14th and 15th at the Tulalip Resort and Spa in Tulalip, Washington.
ASCA's 2020 Winter Seminars in New Orleans, Louisiana is January 16th through the 18th.
ARN's Global Surgical Conference is in Anaheim, California, March 28th through April 1st.
The Iowa Association of ASC's 12th Annual Education Conference is April 17th and 18th, 2020 in Johnston, Iowa.
And of course, ASCA 2020 is in Orlando, Florida, May 13th through the 16th. More information to follow. I'm involved in the education committee, so at some point here we'll have a discussion as to what's on the agenda for that conference.
Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again, and please spread the word about our podcast to your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. and Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.